The Bull of Rome. Chapter 5. Wittenberg. While the inhabitants of the Eternal City were thus agitated, more tranquil scenes were passing at Wittenberg. Melanchthon was there diffusing a mild but brilliant light. From 1,500 to 2,000 auditors, collecting from Germany, England, the Low Countries, France, Italy, Hungary, and Greece, were often assembled around him. He was 24 years of age, and had not entered the ecclesiastical state. There were none in Wittenberg who were not delighted to receive the visits of this young professor, at once so learned and so amiable. Foreign universities, Ingolstadt in particular, desired to attract him within their walls. His Wittenberg friends were eager to retain him among them by the ties of marriage. Although Luther wished that his dear friend Philip might find a consort, he openly declared that he would not be his adviser in this matter. Others took this task upon themselves. The young doctor frequented, in particular, the house of the burgomaster Krapp, who belonged to an ancient family. Krapp had a daughter named Catherine, a woman of mild character and great sensibility. Melanchthon's friends urged him to demand her in marriage, but the young scholar was absorbed in his books, and would hear no mention of anything besides. His Greek authors and his testament were his delight. The arguments of his friends he met with other arguments. At length they extorted his consent. All the preliminary steps were arranged, and Catherine was given him to wife. He received her very coldly, and said with a sigh, "It is God's will. I must renounce my studies and my pleasures to comply with the wishes of my friends." He appreciated, however, Catherine's good qualities. "The young woman," said he, "has just such a character and education as I should have asked of God, dexia o theos tekmezoito. Certainly she deserves a better husband." Matters were settled in the month of August. The betrothal took place on the 25th of September, and at the end of November the wedding was celebrated. Old John Luther with his wife and daughters visited Wittenberg on this occasion. Many learned men and people of note were present at the nuptials. The young bride felt as much affection as the young professor gave evidence coldness. Always anxious about her husband, Catherine grew alarmed at the least prospect of any danger that threatened her dear partner. Whenever Melanchthon proposed taking any step of such a nature as to compromise himself, she overwhelmed him with entreaties to renounce it. "I was compelled," wrote Melanchthon on one such occasion, "to give way to her weakness. Such is our lot. How many infidelities in the church may have had a similar origin. Perhaps we should ascribe to Catherine's influence the timidity and fears with which her husband has so often been reproached." Catherine was an affectionate mother as well as loving wife. She was liberal in her alms to the poor. "O God, do not abandon me in my old age, when my hair begins to turn gray." Such was the daily prayer of this pious and timid woman. Melanchthon was soon conquered by his wife's affection. When he had once tasted the joys of domestic life, he felt all their sweetness. He was formed for such pleasures. Nowhere did he feel himself happier than with Catherine and his children. A French traveler one day finding the master of Germany, rocking his child's cradle with one hand, and holding a book in the other, started back with surprise. But Melanchthon, without being disconcerted, explained to him with so much warmth the value of children in the eyes of God, that the stranger quitted the house wiser, to use his own words, than he had entered it. Melanchthon's marriage gave a domestic circle to the Reformation. There was from this time one house in Wittenberg always open to those who were inspired by the new life. The concourse of strangers was immense. They came to Melanchthon on 1,000 different matters, and the established regulations of his household enjoined him to refuse nothing to anyone. The young professor was extremely disinterested whenever good was to be done. When all his money was spent, he would secretly carry his plate to some merchant, caring little about depriving himself of it, since it gave him wherewithal to comfort the distressed. "Accordingly, it would have been impossible for him to provide for the wants of himself and family," says his friend Camerarius, "if a divine and secret blessing had not from time to time furnished him the means." His good nature was extreme. He possessed several ancient gold and silver medals, remarkable for their inscriptions and figures. He showed them one day to a stranger who called upon him. "Take any one you like," said Melanchthon. "I should like them all," replied the stranger. "I confess," says Philip, "that this unreasonable request displeased me a little at first. I nevertheless gave them to him." There was in Melanchthon's writings a perfume of antiquity, which did not, however, prevent the sweet savor of Christ from exhaling from every part, while it communicated to them an inexpressible charm. There is not one of his letters addressed to his friends in which we are not reminded in the most natural manner of the wisdom of Homer, Plato, Cicero, and Pliny, Christ ever remaining his master and his God. Spalatin had asked him the meaning of this expression of Jesus Christ, "Without me ye can do nothing," John 15 verse 5. Melanchthon referred him to Luther, "Cur agam gestum, spectant ratio?" To use Cicero's words, said he. He then continues, "This passage signifies that we must be absorbed in Christ, so that we ourselves no longer act, but Christ lives in us. As the divine nature was incorporated with the human in the person of Christ, so man must be incorporated with Jesus Christ by faith." The illustrious scholar generally retired to rest shortly after supper. At 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning he was again at his studies. It was during these early hours that his best works were written. His manuscripts usually lay on the table exposed to the view of every visitor, so that he was robbed of several. When he had invited any of his friends to his house, he used to beg one of them to read before sitting down to table some small composition in prose or verse. He always took some young men with him during his journeys. He conversed with them in a manner at once amusing and instructive. If the conversation languished, each of them had to recite in turn passages extracted from the ancient poets. He made frequent use of irony, tempering it, however, with great mildness. "He scratches and bites," said he of himself, "and yet he does no harm." Learning was his passion. The great object of his life was to diffuse literature and knowledge. Let us not forget that in his estimation the Holy Scriptures ranked far above the writings of pagan authors. "I apply myself solely to one thing," said he, "the defense of letters. By our example we 518 must excite youth to the admiration of learning, and induce them to live it for its own sake, and not for the advantage that may be derived from it. The destruction of learning brings with it the ruin of everything that is good, religion, morals, divine and human things. The better a man is, the greater his ardor in the preservation of learning, for he knows that of all plagues, ignorance is the most pernicious." Some time after his marriage, Melanchthon, in company with Camerarius and other friends, made a journey to Bretagne in the Palatinate, to visit his beloved mother. As soon as he caught sight of his birthplace, he got off his horse, fell on his knees, and returned thanks to God for having permitted him to see it once more. Margaret almost fainted with joy as she embraced her son. She wished him to stay at Bretagne, and begged him earnestly to adhere to the faith of his fathers. Melanchthon excused himself in this respect, but with great delicacy, lest he should wound his mother's feelings. He had much difficulty in leaving her again, and whenever a traveler brought him news from his natal city, he was as delighted as if he had again returned, to use his own words, to the joys of his childhood. Such was the private life of one of the greatest instruments of the religious revolution of the 16th century. A disturbance, however, occurred to trouble these domestic scenes and the studious activity of Wittenberg. The students came to blows with the citizens. The rector displayed great weakness. We may imagine what was Melanchthon's sorrow at beholding the excesses committed by these disciples of learning. Luther was indignant. He was far from desiring to gain popularity by an unbecoming conciliation. The opprobrium these disorders reflected on the university pierced him to the heart. He went into the pulpit and preached forcibly against these seditions, calling upon both parties to submit to the magistrates. His sermon occasioned great irritation. "Satan," said he in one of his letters, "being unable to attack us from without, desires to injure us from within. I do not fear him, but I fear lest God's anger should fall upon us, for not having fully received his word. These last 3 years I have been thrice exposed to great danger, at Augsburg in 1518, at Leipzig in 1519, and now in 1520 at Wittenberg. It is either by wisdom nor by arms that the renovation of the church will be accomplished, but by humble prayer and a bold faith, that puts Christ on our side. My dear friend, unite thy prayers with mine, that the evil spirit may not use this small spark to kindle a great conflagration.